Welcome to the Cigar Lounge, the official podcast of the Cigar Peg, where you get to know your friends a little better, learn a little bit more about each other, and grow as a community. And today, we invite, welcome, and bring Dale Irvin into the Cigar Lounge. Dale, how are you?
I'm fine. I've never been welcomed and brought into something at the same time. It's kind of very nice of you.
Yes. Do you like what I've done in here, the inner sanctum? It's pretty, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, it's beautiful. You know, I'd say everybody needs to surround themselves with everything they like.
Yeah, we just added the waterfall and the palm trees this week. They're for you. I hope
Thank
you like them.
Thank you. Good. Very nice. Yeah, very nice. Yeah. I like the monkey is new too, I think.
The monkey's around. About a month old. I'm sorry. Yes.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, all no. He's that's why he's so quiet. Because he knows that he has to behave during podcasts, because if he bangs his cymbals, it makes too much noise. So, you know, Dale, I do these interviews and I get to ask people these cool questions. And when it comes to you, we all know you, we all love you, we all hear from you. And I guess I would start by saying, how did you get into this racket?
That's a very interesting question. When I got out of college, as I went to college because there was a war going on, and I majored in finance. I don't know other than the reason that my brother majored in, and he had a job. So I majored in finance, which just bored the dickens out of me, but it did prepare me for my first job, which was to sell life insurance. And I did that for about, I don't know, six and a half months before I completely ran out of relatives. And then from there, I had some other jobs. I wound up in a little combination printing store advertising agency. That was a big thing. Anyhow, my friend from college calls me. He said, "Hey, you want to move to Chicago and be a media buyer for an ad agency?" I go, "You bet. What is that?"
Wait. Where were you when you were in this?
I was in Cleveland. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
All right.
So I was still working in Cleveland. And my friend calls me from Chicago and he says, "Would you like to do this?" I said, "Yeah, well, what is it?" He said, "I'll tell you, it's no big deal. You go out to lunch a lot." So I moved to Chicago and I started learning all about the advertising business. And then I moved on to another advertising agency. And while I was there in downtown Chicago, I noticed that they were running classes for improv at the Second City. I figure I got to take these because it seems like a good idea. And so I took a year and a half of classes at Second City. Then I formed my own improv group with four other people. And we played a lot of, what would you call them, joints in Chicago. And then my advertising career all of a sudden took a nosedive. I got fired. And I got fired 3-4 months after my daughter had been born. So it was not good. So I decided, hey, I'm going to try comedy.
Let me just make sure. The reason you knew it wasn't good is because you have a finance degree.
I'm just making sure. Finance to back it up.
I want our listeners to understand how this all comes together.
Okay. I knew from my degree that I didn't have any money. So anyhow, I decided to try comedy. And I had been working on an act locally at New Talent Nights and stuff. And I put myself out there and started working anywhere. And so I worked just about every comedy club, I think, in the country. And then I discovered cruise ships, which paid more than comedy clubs. And they were cruise ships. And I did that for quite a while. And then I discovered speaking, because when I was still in the advertising business, I was told to give a little presentation to a group of people who had a finance guy in there called Hal Morris. And Hal was a very big financial guy back in the early days of NSA. And he came up to me after my little joke session. He said, "Have you ever thought about doing this for a living?" I said, "You can?" He said, "Yeah, that's what I do. I speak to people." And he turned me on to NSA and I started going there. and learn stuff. And the first thing I learned is that conventions, as opposed to comedy clubs, are usually held in very nice places. And there's no such thing as a convention condo, which is where they put up comics. And that's, you know, that's claimed semi-annually.
And but, so that's six comics, three mattresses, and a broken coffee pot, right?
And a waitress. For the other guys. Yeah. And so anyhow, I started doing that and I thought, well, I'll do these humorous after dinner speeches that I see people doing. And the problem was, there's a lot of people doing them. Now, my background at Second City allowed me to think real quickly about stuff and hone my skills as a smartass. And so I was doing that in the back of the room with John Dolan. And when I got a call from Judy Morio, who was also was an NSA speaker. She said, are you going to the winter workshop? I said, I believe I am. She goes, could you do me a favor? I'm supposed to announce some kind of talent show they have for the convention, and I'm going to be in Africa. I said, sure, I can do that. How much time did they give me? She said, they gave me 10 minutes. I said, I don't need 10 minutes to say, send your tapes in for the talent show. So I filled the other 9 minutes with jokes I had just written about what happened in the morning. Okay. Well, from there, the other winter workshop thing saw me and it just started rolling in NSA. And I had Michelle Lemons, actually, was the first one who come up to me. She says, can you do this all the time? I said, yeah. She goes, I can sell it. And that's how it was all born. So it was something that nobody else was doing. So I kind of had a corner on the market and I really, really like doing it because I get bored from doing the same thing over and over.
Well,
and
Dale, you went through that and I lost time reference, meaning, okay, so when you became a speaker, how much time had you already had in on the comedy circuit and cruise ships?
Well, I became a speaker, I went to my first NSA meeting and I was still working on cruise ships and stuff. So I kind of eased over to it. Even when I was on cruises, every so often I'd take off a cruise because I had a speaking engagement somewhere. Okay. So they kind of combined. Everything didn't really catch on for me in the summarizer thing born until 1992.
Oh, okay. All right. And so let me ask, because I want to know, I would like to know the first and second most embarrassing things that ever happened to you in a comedy club.
I don't know if I'd go with embarrassing or frightening, but I can tell you both of them.
Let's go with frightening.
I'm working a comedy club on the south side of Chicago, and it was a small little club, which was a restaurant during the day and a club at night. And I had a heckler who was just, you know, yelling stupid stuff out. And so I was, you know, yelling equally things to him. And so, he was just getting really obnoxious, and he got up and he was going to leave. I said, sir, at least can you tell me, did you have a great time tonight? He said, I had an effing wonderful time, took his mug of beer and threw it at me on stage. Now, the comedy clubs back there, it all had brick backgrounds and that shattered. And I said, excuse me, but I wanted a Bud Light. And this caused him to erupt. And he and his friend walked out of there and knocked over a gumball machine or something, and then kicked in the front door of the place. Ooh. And the audience was all in awe. And I said, folks, I don't mean to alert you, but if he just did that to our club, just imagine what he's doing to your cars right now. And the place emptied.
Nice. Well, that's one way to force a standing ovation.
Exactly.
They all jumped up
and ran out the door to protect their cars.
So, I got to ask, because I know everybody has one. I want a great cruise ship story.
A great cruise ship story. Well, we used to go to the Bahamas a lot. And in Nassau, there is a bar called the Green Shutters. It was based on a British pub type thing, but they served a drink called a CMF, which stands for Caribbean Mother Fornicator. And it had eight different rums in it. It was a tasty drink and just delicious to drink. After one, you're kind of loopy. After two, you're really goon-faced. And if you have three, you hope you make it back on the ship. So my friend and I were drinking there one afternoon. We started asking the bartender, he said, what's in this drink? He said, oh, no, it's a secret. So we started piling more money on the tip pile, and eventually he told us. We then went to the nearest liquor store and bought all the liquor, brought it back on board, and started making cocktails. First, it was for all of our friends in the cabin. And then I said, oh, this is too good. We got to share this with everybody. So I went up to the disco and just started pouring drinks out of a pitcher.
Oh,
well,
shit.
The bar manager saw that people were snorting those down. He wasn't too happy because he wasn't making any money on that.
Oh my God.
And it was an interesting time.
Well, do you remember the recipe? Because I'm sure we all want it now.
Oh, I have it written down. Oh, yes, I have it. It's yeah. So I don't have it handy, but it, yeah. It's
no, but if the members of the Cigar Peg want it bad enough, they will join a Wednesday call and ask you for it.
There you go.
Does that work?
I could certainly do that. Good. Yeah, that's certainly.
Good.
You know, anyhow, the other embarrassing thing. Wait, this other story is good too. This was going to be my Johnny Carson story. And I was working a little club in Dayton, Ohio, and it was a small club, bar primarily. It had a stage, maybe about platform, maybe about 4 foot by 4 foot. And I'm up there and I got a guy sitting right to my left. He's like right in my face and he's just heckling me. And I kept giving it back to him. And eventually he just got up and walked in front of the stage and out the front door. And I felt bad. I didn't want him to leave, really. I just wanted him to shut up. He comes back 5 minutes later holding this huge two-handed claymore sword, waving it over his head, puts it down on the ground with the point on, puts his hands on the hilt. It goes, now be funny. And at that point, I had a blank gun that I was using as a prop in the act, and I had already used it, and it was just sitting on the stool. And I just picked it up. I said, gee, I kind of wish this was real now. And a little black guy in a three-piece suit sitting right in front of me opens up his jacket and he says, don't worry, brother, this one is, and I like you. And he was wearing a piece. So that was another close call gotten by.
So, I guess that's where this interview, I like this interview to go with these things because, by the way, I should mention to everyone that's listening right now that, yeah, I know you all expected this to drop on March 29th, but there was no way I was not letting this drop on any other day except April Fool's. So I appreciate you joining us on a different day rather than a Wednesday. So Dale,
I love April Fool's Day, man. That's my favorite. My favorite April Fool's trick, and I'll share it with everybody.
Please,
is you go to some place, like Starbucks or your coffee place. You get a nice big cup. In that cup, you drop one or two what they're called Earth magnets. You can get them at Home Depot and such. They're very small, very powerful magnets. Put those in the bottom of the cup, and then put the cup on the hood of your car. It won't blow off. And people just come up to you beeping the horn and pointing. And I just have a sign that says April Fools. It's my favorite trick every year.
Yeah, we're going to run this early in the day on April Fools so everybody can join in, Dale. Yes, I like this. So, you've had a really, I want to say, a fun career. You're a fun human. And I know you roast people at the end of a conference and summarize for them, but I want to talk. I really like this fun thing about talking to you about the dumbest things you've ever seen. What's the stupidest thing you've ever seen at a convention or a conference that you had to summarize?
Well, I don't know if it was stupidest. It was the oddest. Well,
you pick any adjective.
It was a convention for people that sell a device. To to help people who have artery disease. It's kind of like a little mini tiny Roto-Rooter that goes through your veins. And it's a very high technical medical device. And if I ever had that problem, I would call them immediately. But I walked into the room for the meeting, and I was kind of surprised to see that in the ballroom, there were four bars set up serving everybody before the meeting. And apparently that was kind of their culture. And I got up there and I said, you know, this is, you know, kind of weird to see all these bars here and you're selling this, this heart thing. I see it as you just drumming up future business.
True story.
So they kind of like that, but yeah, there's been a lot of weird things. I'm trying to think of the oddest of them all, and it's having a one time I was working a convention in Las Vegas, and it was the end of the thing. It was at Caesars, I believe, and it was the end of the thing, and they're starting to put all the tables away, and I'm still talking with either the meeting planner or somebody who was in charge, and he said, "Hey, you want to go for a ride?" I said, "Where?" And he grabs the golf cart that they were using to pick everything up. Said, "Come on, let's go." And somehow we wound up outside on the strip in a golf cart.
Nice.
And made it back safely. So
and I'm assuming the golf cart is the reason you don't go back to Vegas.
No, that's not the reason. That was another reason. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
The golf cart was fun. The other reason wasn't any fun.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, we don't want to talk about things that aren't fun. So
no, of course,
when you became a speaker, I mean, what kind of, did you attend all kinds of events? Did you have a specific market you were in? Tell me about how you expanded and what you did.
Well, you know, when Michelle Lemons first started booking me, it was with a big financial company. And a lot of the people that were at that convention represented different insurance companies. And word of mouth kind of took me into the insurance field, to the point where I wrote a book called Insurance as a Second Language, because I knew that they'd want to buy stuff after their conventions. And it was a very funny book about insurance. But yeah, I did a lot of life insurance companies. I spoke for MDRT, the Million Dollar Roundtable, which is the penultimate convention for life insurance salespeople. And they pride themselves on never having a speaker back a second time. I was there 7 years in a row. So
awesome.
They liked what I did because it was always different. It was never the same. So
it's not a canned speech.
No.
And everybody that knows you knows how perfectly responsive you are to whatever's happening in the room. Contrary to popular belief, Dale pays attention. So, well, we can't say that about everybody. Not me. I don't pay attention. Dale, if you could start all over again. You said that you got finance degree because your brother got it and you thought you could get a job and get employed. If you could do it all over again, what would you do? What would you have done differently?
I would have gone to college, but I would have majored in something possibly, you know, something useless, theater, or something like that, you know, because I didn't really get a whole kick out of playing with numbers and things like that. So, yeah, I would have. I mean, they have degrees now here in Illinois, I think at the University of Illinois in microbrewing. You can get a degree as a microbrewer. Had that happened, I'd still be in college. Oh. I mean, you know, what the heck? But yeah, I would have gotten something that really did. I couldn't use anywhere else. But probably theater.
All right, I was just curious. And then, so would you have started in your comedy career sooner? Knowing what you know now, would you have started sooner?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was a latecomer to comedy.
Yeah.
I didn't start until I was in my 30s. And, you know, these other guys were starting when they were 20. And, but yeah, I would have started a lot sooner. The only thing is that, you know, at the beginning, there weren't that many comedy clubs in Chicago at the time. I believe there were three, and then that blossomed out to a bunch. But it was hard, you know, you had to travel quite a bit to find all the different comedy clubs.
Well, and other than Second City, so obviously you got some improv training at Second City, then you started your own, but throughout that, becoming a comedian, not a speaker as much yet, but a comedian, who were your mentors, your heroes? Who were you looking up to at that time?
My three heroes in the comedy business were Steve Allen, who had the quickest wit of any comic, I believe. Johnny Carson, who had the best timing. And he said that he learned all his timing from Jack Benny. And then George Carlin, who had just the weirdest view of everything. And I really enjoyed that. I used to, what I used to do when I was starting out in comedy, so I'd read the newspaper and I'd write jokes about what happened in the newspaper and then watch Johnny Carson that night and see if I was even close on any of them.
Oh, that's great. That's a good test. And I was going to ask you that. There's a lot of people out there that give speeches, and I know people take a lot of improv. What advice could you give to speakers on writing comedy?
You have to open your eyes and you have to look at everything. 99% of comedy comes from stuff that you just see or read or watch or hear. And you just have to, you have to open your eyes to that, because it's, you know, it's something that you can't really train, but you look at everything. And I always ask myself, WTF, where's the funny? Because there's funny everywhere, you know, and it just you have to look at it. I mean, I saw a thing the other day, which, you know, you have to see if you can find funny in tragedy. And it said that the Cleveland Browns in Ohio, where that big train wreck was, are happy that now they are no longer the biggest disaster in Ohio. So, you know, that was, it's really, it's a bad joke, but it's kind of funny.
No, it's, yeah, I get it. Have you ever told a joke at a moment that you know you just shouldn't have said what you said?
Yeah, once or twice it occurred to me that I wish I could take that back. You know, one time I was working at a comedy club at Zany's, and the talent coordinator from David Letterman was in the audience. And so I got up there and I wrote this joke that afternoon that I thought was just going to be a great kickoff. And I got through the setup and I went white on the punchline. I could not remember the punchline. And so I'm just standing there. And so it's like, these two guys walk into a bar and anyhow, I'll get back to that. And the guy from Letterman comes up to me and said, "That was a really weird beginning you had, but I think you kind of made it work." He never hired me, but that's the only time I really whited out and couldn't remember where I was going.
And let me tell you that I can tell you I've had that happen. And I'm going to give you some advice that you're going to appreciate, Dale. Me looking up to you, giving you advice, and you'll understand it. Every time I black out on stage, I do the same thing. We're the aristocrats.
Absolutely.
I don't care
Absolutely.
If the audience knows why I did it. It just tells me I had a moment. Yeah. And I think that's probably something we should avoid talking about is the aristocrats. But I guess
the aristocrats, for those who don't know it, it's a joke that is pretty much entirely improvised by the teller. And the trick is to make it as disgusting and gut-wrenching as you can while still keeping it funny. There is a whole movie about it called The Aristocrats, and it's just it's very funny.
Yeah, I was going to say that the thing about the aristocrats that people need to know is that you got to have the setup. The guy walks into the talent agent says, "What's the act about?" That's the setup. Then there's the act. The act is as gross and as nasty and as horrible as you can make it. And the punchline is the aristocrats. So that's explaining the moment Dale and I just had. and I was going to say, if you have to ask somebody to please tell you how to tell the joke, yeah, you probably shouldn't tell it. So Dale,
just Google it. You'll get the joke.
Let me ask you something. And talking about that, I have a serious question for you. And in order to keep this clean, I'm just going to say you've been around in comedy a very long time. What is your experience with what I call the introduction of the F-bomb and other foul language into comedy to help make things funny?
Well, if it's used in the pattern, like for instance, Richard Pryor could get away with it. That's kind of the way he talked all the time. And Lenny Bruce went to jail for it, you know, but he used it for emphasis. Too many times people use it because they can't think of anything else. And they just think, oh, that'll get a laugh. But it doesn't. And it has very few uses, you know, outside of the dingy comedy club. You can't use it in the corporate world. At least I never would. And there are very few things that I would never do. But yeah, I think the thing that killed or is killing comedy right now, however, is on the other side of the scale with political correctness. Mm-hmm. You can't say anything about anybody without offending everybody. And it's to the point where a lot of good comedians, Seinfeld for one of them, you won't work colleges anymore. You said it's too restricting.
Yeah, it's got to hurt. I mean, it's funny, but I mean, you look at some of these acts, and I know there's a perpetual joke out there, but Blazing Saddles.
Exactly. Couldn't produce it today.
It would never work. And I noticed that Mel Brooks has come out now. I saw on TV an ad for the History of the World Part 2 is finally coming out.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's going to be on one of the streaming channels. And I have no idea how he's going to clean up the history of the world and make Part 2 funny. But I'm dying to see it when it comes out.
I love Mel Brooks. Everything he's done, his latest book was just a fantastic read. He talks about his whole career and goes through all the different movies and such and what had to be done. So it's, yeah, I like Mel Brooks a lot.
Well, I know, Dale, you do the Friday funnies, and I know they're, you mentioned about, you know, trying to do the headlines with Carson or whatever, but you do the Friday funnies and they're contemporary, they're real. In putting those together, and I want to glimpse behind the curtain, the comedic talent of Dale, how long does it take you to write the material for your Friday funnies? Is that an all week thing or is it a reflective thing?
Let me give you a quick history of how it developed.
Please.
Back in, I believe, about 1993 or so, I was doing a lot of work with Sprint. And at the time, they had a promotion that all of your calls on Friday were free. And I thought, well, you know, I don't really call that many people. They said, oh, it works for your fax machine too. I said, cool. So I started writing a one page of the Friday funnies, just jokes and things that occurred to me. It wasn't really based on the news at that time. And I faxed them out to everybody I knew who I had their fax numbers. I mean, it took a while because it was all manual, but I did that. And then with the birth of the internet, you know, late 90s, I started doing the video version of it. And it takes me, my whole process is I start looking for news stories every day in the early part of the week, looking for just weird things that are out there. I devote Thursday to writing them. Thursday morning, I will write the funnies. It generally takes me about an hour. And then I'll let them sit for a little while and then rewrite them. Then I will record them, and that generally takes me, you know, half an hour. And then the editing is the longest part, and that takes a couple of hours. But it's all day Thursday that I put it together. But I'm always looking for stories. And now a lot of people are starting to send me stories, which is even greater because it enhances my ability to find weird stuff.
Well, do you test material on anyone?
As far as the Friday funnies is concerned, I give it to my wife. She was a school teacher and she is my grandma, my grammatically correct person, and she has a very fine sense of when I've gone too far. So so that helps. As far as the rest of the stuff, what things that I do at conventions, no, there's nobody to test it on.
Oh, no, I meant writing over the years, like when you even putting together Friday Funnies now, or just learning to write comedy, did you ever find yourself testing it?
Oh, I test jokes all the time. Every time I go to the store, you know, whenever I'm out, I'll try a material that I've just thought of. But yeah, I always test it. But if I put it into a show, I'm pretty confident it's going to work. Yeah. I may be wrong. I have been in the past, but I'm pretty confident it's going to work.
Do you have a pattern of how you test?
Not really.
Okay.
I'll run it by a couple of friends of mine first, who are also very funny people. And then, like I said, I'll just try it on people I see around town and stuff.
But I'm asking because I want people to know to test their humor, because frankly, sometimes the stuff that you say is really stupid and embarrassing. But if you don't test it, you don't know that.
That is true. That is true. Yeah, you should always... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Steve Martin did a master class on comedy I listened to years ago. And it's funny because I always jokingly say when I die, I'm writing a letter of apology to all the people I've tested jokes on. I'm not sure their lives will be the same.
I will also throw them up on Facebook from time to time, okay, just to see how many, you know, smiley faces I get, and then I'll work that joke into a bigger sketch.
And I know right now, as we close out, I mean, you're pretty much, I want to say, you're retired mostly.
Yes.
Moving in a different direction. Are you actually doing any marketing or any work right now? Or are you just doing residual work?
I'm not really doing any active marketing. I'm kind of switching from performing to writing. I love writing. I love staying in my office all day and just pounding the keys. And the performing that I do now is on camera. So I don't really have an urge like a lot of my friends do. I got to get on stage. I was on stage. It was nice. It was fun. It's time to move on for me.
No, okay. No, I'm asking that for the reason that is I knew you were writing now. If someone in the Cigar Peg reaches out to you, they can hire you to punch up their material and make it funnier, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm still writing jokes I've written jokes from everybody from corporate executives to ministers. I mean, yeah, I love to do that kind of thing. That's primarily what I do. I mean, I write jokes every day.
And if somebody needs to reach out to you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Easiest way is dale@daleirvin.com. So that will get right to me because, you know, I'm Dale Irvin. There's another, if you Google Dale Irvin, though, you might come up with a guy who is a Presbyterian minister by the same name. And I would imagine I've gotten a few of his emails, and Lord, I hope he didn't get any of mine.
Okay. at that rate, no, that way people can reach out and get a hold of you. And if they dial your phone number and they dial the wrong area code, much like I did today, they'll get this very pleasant woman on the phone who covers for Dale and pretends she doesn't know him. But everybody, I want to say, Dale, thank you for joining us in the Cigar Lounge. It was a blast today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I've had a lot of fun, and Cigar Peg rules.
Yes, it does. Thank you, Dale.
You're welcome.
And we thank you, our listener members. Please join us every 2 weeks as we drop a new episode, placing another Cigar Peg member in the spotlight of the Cigar Lounge.